The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extended Fitbar Corner. Scotland, Ryan Christie's sweet left foot, David Marshall's firm left wrist, and of course the absolute agony in between. All of it means the Tartan Army are at a major tournament for the first time since 1998. They won't be joined by Northern Ireland, letting in two sloppy goals to Slovakia, with most of their players barely able to walk at the end of extra time. England find the one opponent less interested in friendlies than them. How many brilliant performances until Jack Grealish is the only name on the team sheet? And what was the point of the game anyway? Joe Gomez injured in the build-up. Are the players being pushed too hard? We'll discuss Greg Clark's resignation from the FA. Quite the achievement to insult so many minorities in one sitting. There's also a WSL preview, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Zinzan Donovan writes, couldn't do a Friday pod for the Europa League, could you? Another example of the liberal, metropolitan, anti-Spurs, Arsenal, Leicester, Wolves, Man United, Chelsea, Burnley brackets for a short-time agenda. You're absolutely right, Zinzan, but we can for the Euro playoffs on the panel today. Anne-Marie Batson, hello.
Good morning, good morning.
Good morning, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, how are you?
I'm marvellous, thank you. Hello, John Bruin.
Hello, Max.
Alistair says, a full pod version of Fitbar Corner. Yeah, to talk Scotland. Friend of the pod, comedian Jim Burke. Jim, how are you?
I'm good, Max, surprisingly.
Yeah. So for the first time, Scotland get through to a major tournament since 1998 in a group with England, Croatia and the Czech Republic, winning on penalties after David Marshall saved Alexander Mitrovic's penalty in the shootout, stared at the ref to check it wouldn't be a retake. Apparently the ref had told him not to celebrate until he said it was okay. Bill Barr says, how loudly did Jim scream and for how long?
I'll tell you how long. The girlfriend's daughter came down from her attic bedroom saying, I think something's happened out in the street. Genuinely.
How did that moment feel?
Do you know what? I wasn't prepared for it because I'm just been so inured since Argentina 78 to constant disappointment. And even when we gave away the equalising goal, it was a corner that didn't look like a corner. And I thought, they're going to score for this because that's Scotland. And lo and behold, they scored. So the penalties, I just thought, was a, you know, foregone conclusion. Somebody blazing it over the bar, not even a good save by the keeper, but you know, like a Baggio, like that kind of miss. So that's what I was prepared for. So I did what Ryan Christie did. I was genuinely in tears. I'm not proud of that, but bloody hell, it was marvellous.
You didn't sleep last night?
No, when I got to bed, I was like, I just couldn't. I was so buzzing, and I wasn't even drinking last night. Because I think if I'd opened one can, I would have opened 30. Do you know what I mean? So I was glad of that, but just was so happy. So happy.
And how did you find those interviews at the end? You know, Ryan Christie sort of crying and just mid-interview just going, oh, God. And Andy Robertson's voice cracking, saying, you know, I'm just a boy who's so lucky to walk out in front of them. And even like, you know, seeing Chris Boyd on Sky Sports News absolutely not hold it together when that penalty was saved, or watching, I think, can't remember who it was, tweeting, yeah, and Andy saying, you know, Ellie Barber, McFadden and Darren Fletcher gone from speaking English to needing subtitles in just about an hour. Watching those interviews of the players, how did that make you feel?
Because it just summed up exactly how I was feeling. I mean, if I'd spoke to you 10 minutes after the final whistle, I would have been really struggling to hold it together. Because, and again, that it came completely out of the blue for me because I'm not, you know, I just wasn't prepared for it. It was fantastic. But it is just that, I mean, Christie said it in his interview, it's been a rotten year. You know, it's been, and nothing, there's been little in the way of joy. And then just to have that after 22 years, you know, I'd forgot just how it felt. Fantastic.
And Barry, they deserved it. Like, I don't think I've seen Scotland play attacking football for years.
Yeah, they were by far the better team over the 90 minutes. They had a plan. They stuck to it. They were good on the ball. They were good off the ball. Lyndon Dykes was absolutely outstanding up front. He's a guy I hadn't really heard of before, I think, about three or four, the last international break, probably. He plays up front for QPR and had been in Scotland before that, having arrived from Australia. He was brilliant. Ryan Christie was brilliant. John McGinn was brilliant. David Marshall, obviously, is the hero for saving the penalty. But I think, you know, all the players deserve credit. I thought the manner, when they conceded that late equaliser, I thought, right, that's it, they're gone, they're out. And I thought they did quite well to hang on in extra time because they were dead on their feet. But the composure with which they all took their penalties, it was incredible, I thought. It was absolutely remarkable. And the Serbia keeper got a hand to at least one, if not two or three. And I was watching it, actually. It's funny, cause the things you think about, it just made me think of the people who were defending Ademola Lookman for his Panenka last weekend. And I was one of them originally. And then I was thinking, well, if you blast it and the keeper gets a hand to it, there's still a chance it will go in. And that happened last night. I think Steve Clark deserves an absolutely huge amount of credit. He does his own thing. He knows what his plan is. He knows what he wants to do. And he doesn't pay any heed whatsoever to any of the armchair experts who tell him what he should be doing. And they're now, what is it, 9 unbeaten? 6 wins, 3 draws, if you don't count the penalty shootouts as wins. And that is phenomenal for Scotland, like absolutely phenomenal. And when you think how this campaign's, I think it was their first game, they got battered by Kazakhstan, for them to actually recover from that and qualify is remarkable. I'm delighted for them.
I'm delighted for them, and I was really delighted. And then I started looking at this team and thinking, you know, after years of basically mocking, you know, Scotland international performances, going, hang on, Robertson's good, Tierney's good, McGinn is a lovely player, Dykes gives them a real focal point. Anne-Marie, I'm slightly nervous about that game in the Euros now.
I think you and me both, you and me both. I mean, I'm delighted for Scotland as well. I know it was the same as you, Max. When I was looking at the team sheet, I thought, you know, there's Scott McTominay's there, Andy Robinson's in that team. I'm thinking there's some decent players in that Scotland team. And Barry's absolutely right about Steve Clarke. He deserves a huge, huge amount of credit. And I'm amazed how much he held it together in his post-match interview last night, because he was so composed. He was, you know, full of praise for the team, full of praise for the backroom staff as well, which I thought was really lovely. And I think we tend to forget that he had a decent managerial career in the Premier League. He took West Brom to 10th. In the Premier League. I mean, obviously things didn't exactly work out afterwards, but I think he does have some calibre behind him. But bringing those players through, I mean, one stat that really blew me away yesterday is the fact that last time the men's team qualified, as we know, which was back in 1998, Andy Robinson was 4 years old. Let that sink in for a moment. And for him and for other players now get the opportunity, part of that generation of the men's team, they get that opportunity to play at Wembley, against England, also face Spain. I'm so excited for them over the next few months. They're going to be absolutely buzzing. And you're all right, it's come at the right time, because this year has been absolutely horrific. It gives the nation a real big lift. As an English person, I'm delighted for Scotland. I can't wait for that Wembley meetup.
John, last night you were talking about Lyndon Dykes and sort of how impressed you were with him. It's quite an interesting trend of, I've written smaller nations, or not lesser nations, Jim, but you know, to have that kind of focal point, like sort of like Kiefer Moore for Wales, a bit like Josh McGinn sort of was doing for Northern Ireland, and then I wrote Olivier Giroud, but that's probably not fair. But I thought Dykes was superb last night, John.
Yeah, and they suffered, didn't they, once he'd been taken off, because he'd worked so hard. There was a point during the game where they showed him breathing really, really hard, like he'd completely worked himself into the ground. Yeah, I mean, he is one of those players. I mean, he's Australian by birth and has gone to play for them. And like Barry, I wasn't too aware of his talents, but in the prelims for the game, they were talking about what an effective player he is. And international football tends to be a bit simpler in approach. And if you've got someone that can hold up the ball, that counts for a lot, particularly in a game when you are expected to be on the back foot. Yeah, I just got to echo everybody's thoughts, really. I remember Scotland being serial qualifiers, serial exiters at the group stage, I should say, at this point. So, when I was watching that game last night, I had some sort of music going through my head, and whenever I think of Scotland, I always think of Rod Stewart, "You're in My Heart." Then when things started going wrong, it was Sunshine on Leith, Sorrow. But now it's Delamitri's "Don't Come Home Too Soon." But the problem is with that is they're actually playing at home in the tournament. So it was a genuinely emotional occasion. This week has been, I think, a good week in terms of news.
Hasn't it?
Dominic Cummings going even better. This was just brilliant. Well done, Scotland.
It's just nice seeing your beaming face in the corner. It's just really lovely to see. I mean, David Marshall, it's a great moment for him, their longest serving player. And he made one save in extra time, which was phenomenal, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that again was when I thought, that's the goal. You know, when he saved that, I thought, hang on. You know, I allowed myself a small moment of optimism, which, as you know, isn't easy. But I just keep saying that it's incredible. It's just absolutely incredible. I mean, Barry said it a few times, that the Scotland team looks good on paper, but hasn't really transferred that onto the grass. But just every single game, they've just got better. The players have got more, in, you know, more of an idea of their roles. They're very, very disciplined, and it may just be the post-game euphoria. But I'm not scared about the game against England, because I live in England, but to look at it from an English person, this is exactly the sort of game that England quite often get wrong.
Oh, here we go.
You know, no, they do. You know, up against a stuffy, dull opponent, you know, a stuffy dull, he'll put Grealish on the bench, hopefully, right? We don't want any of that Gaza 96 type scenario. Keep all your creative players as far away from the game as possible, right? Play your dull centre midfield players. And then just let us nick a goal, hold on to it, and that'll do me nicely.
Well, it's important you remember, Jim, that going into this game on, what is it, June the 18th, the English media won't in any way be at all overconfident about their chances of securing victory. They won't at all see it as a foregone conclusion. I see the popular disc jockey Danny Baker has already been trumpeting how easy England's group is. I'm not sure if he was being facetious. I don't think he was, saying that there would need to be some sort of judicial inquiry if they even dropped a point against Scotland, the Czech Republic or Croatia. I'm really looking forward to that.
I enjoyed how Serbia, after the penalty shootout, went sort of slightly Donald Trump and refused to accept the decision for quite a long time, didn't they?
Yeah,
Carl
yeah.
says, now Scotland have qualified for a major tournament. Is it now inevitable that COVID will make sure the tournament is cancelled? Would be just your luck, isn't it? Andy Robertson wrote he'll be having a cheeky Vimto in memory of his auntie Vera. Yuri Geller claimed credit for this. I believe in my powers. Well done, Scotland. I'm inviting you all to my private Scottish island for more inspiration. Lamb Island, heart emoji. He recorded himself. What was he doing, John? Was there a wasn't a spoon there, was I? I'm making that up. He was
this time. The spoons were left in the drawer this time. Yeah, I think. Well, he seemed to be suggesting that he was pretty well, whatever Yuri Geller does, compelling them to victory in the penalty shootout. Someone else raised this point. I do wonder if he does this for every game, then we don't get to see the offcuts. So since 1998, because he's felt guilty over the Gary McAllister penalty back in 1996. That he's been doing this for every Scottish qualification.
So what you're saying is there's hours and hours and hours of Yuri Geller going, don't go in, don't go in. Oh, sorry, lads, don't go in. somewhere.
Yeah, there's a version of that time they got snotted in Holland, like 5 or 6-0 or whatever it was. You know, for, I think that was for Euro 2004. At various points, so he's not had to work too hard on that process. If I just say one thing, actually, how long ago was it recently that Gordon Strachan was suggesting that Scottish football required some form of genetic engineering to become better? And 5-6 years of that, they've got a whole new generation of players who are doing exactly what the country wanted of them. So patience is a virtue.
Yeah, worth saying that Serbia really weren't up to much. And I was really surprised about that, actually, because they've got, you know, on paper, their team sheet looks great, Anne-Marie.
Yeah, absolutely. When I heard that, you know, Kolarov and Milinkovic-Savic, who both play in Serie A, managed to get out of Italy to play for this particular game, I thought this was going to be really, really tricky. And then, of course, the news broke that Milivojevic from Crystal Palace tested positive for COVID-19. And I thought, there's a slight glimmer of hope here. I mean, this is a team. I always think with Serbia, when I look at them, they're big units. They are big players. They play in a mean way. They play in a very clinical way. They are very ruthless. But for some reason, they just could not get into it yesterday. And I think that's pretty much because Scotland, from the first whistle, was suffocating them from the word go. And you could see the frustration was starting to build very much. And that's a team that also had under-19 players in it as well, under-20s. They're higher up in the world rankings as well in terms of Serbia, 30th, Scotland at 45. You know, on paper, looking at it, Serbia were the absolute favourites, but you know they didn't do their homework yesterday. I would say very much so, and it cost them. And I love the fact that after when Marshall made that save and the ball was drifting away to the Serbian goalkeeper, he kicked it away in such frustration. It was brilliant, brilliant to see from them. But you know, it cost them yesterday. So congratulations to Scotland.
Yeah, Scotland play Slovakia, who also got through in the Nations League on Sunday. I just really want that to be a really hungover game with, you know, players turning up late, people being sick on the pitch. You know, somebody, you know, at Tierney saying, can I go in goal for 10 minutes? I'm just knackered. Anyway, I think it's actually sort of the game. Actually, there is some vague importance to Scotland to win that Nations League group, but I don't think they'll care. Well, listen, Jim, thanks for coming on.
Oh boy.
It was nice to have a happy Scotsman on. It's, you know, it's normally you and Murray, so like, and enjoy it. And we'll get you back on when the English stuff you at Wembley.
I have this image of you and Murray, who's covering the Masters this week, being out in the clubhouse in Augusta begging some stuffy Yank in a blazer to switch the telly over to Serbia, Scotland. And getting very short shrift.
Fuzzy
indeed.
Zeller and Craig Stadler refusing to hand over the remote to you and Murray. Cheers, Jim. Thanks for coming on.
No bother, Max. Thanks a lot. Cheers, guys.
Slovakia got through as well. They beat Northern Ireland. Richard says, any advice for a heartbroken Northern Ireland fan? Peter says, your normal level of Northern Ireland coverage will do just fine. I'm too sad for full analysis. I mean, by the end of extra time, half the team couldn't move. And it'll be tough to take, John, because the goals they conceded were so soft, weren't they?
Oh, the second one in particular. Johnny Evans, who has been such a great servant for Northern Ireland, you could blame him, but it was unfortunate. The ball sort of bounced in a way he couldn't actually see it. You know, it was like when you, a sort of blind spot, like when you're driving a car or something, where the, you know, and then I'm not sure about the goalie. So it was tough. I mean, you know, I suppose it must be for a team that's got to the playoff for Euro 20, which is going to be played in Euro in 2021, at the end of 2020. It's such a long process to come all that way and then lose like that. It was really tough on them. Obviously, they lost Michael O'Neill during that qualifying process. Ian Barraclough's done a decent job with them, but yeah, very sad. They did light up Euro 2016 when they were there. I mean, they didn't play the greatest football, but the fans were great. So, it would have completed a full set of countries from our proud union. But unfortunately, they won't be there.
And they'd had that brilliant 5 minutes, Baz, hadn't they? You know, Paddy McNair doing so well. He had a really good game, I thought, Paddy McNair. And then Carl Lafferty just hitting the post. That last minute, you just think, oh, it's agonising.
Is it? I thought it was hilarious.
You're a horrible man, aren't you?
Oh,
I'm going
no.
to Anne-Marie Berry because I don't think you're giving our Northern Irish listeners the respect that they deserve.
I'm sorry, I just can't feign that kind of sincerity.
I was sad, Anne-Marie, and I don't think either side were brilliant in this game. I thought Slovakia sort of were there for the taking a little bit, but you just felt that Northern Ireland almost conversely to the Scotland game, where you think once Serbia score, you think there's only one winner. When Northern Ireland get that late equaliser, you just sort of think it's for them to win it.
Oh yeah, they were much more composed in the second half, that's for sure. But as John said, though, it was those two defensive mistakes, those two small mistakes, really, really cost them. I think what's interesting for me now, I mean, I would have loved for Northern Ireland to qualify. I think it would have been absolutely brilliant. I think the question is what now for Northern Ireland. There's going to be several players that will not be part of that team going forward. So I think Ian Barraclough, he's got a bit of a job in his hands to be able to select players who are going to be able to score goals for them, because they were lacking in that. I know they got that equaliser, but there were times yesterday that certain forward players just didn't get in the space in front. They were too far back. One player would take it wide, do the crossing just in front of goal, and there'd be nobody there to meet it. So there are several things that need to be looked at from Ian Barraclough's point of view. And I think for them, it was just those two mistakes. Just cost them.
I thought Stuart Dallas played very well, and especially because it looked like he broke his arm early in the first. I was watching him going, he's got to come off. I mean, he was in so much pain. And then by the end, he was just hoying in these long throws. I think it probably shows that elite sports people have a higher pain threshold than me. It's probably the conclusion I made from that. Hungary 2, Iceland 1. Iceland were 1 up in the 88th minute of this game. It was so much last-minute action or sort of late action in these playoffs. Hungary's equaliser was sort of some disastrous pinball defending. I don't know what ping-pong defending is. Slightly different, isn't it? An incredible last-minute winner from Dominik Szoboszlai, who plays for RB Leipzig. Their group, Hungary's group, France, Portugal and Germany. That's a Euros group that I'm really looking forward to. That is the group of death there. And North Macedonia will be in a major tournament for the first time. They won 1-0 in Georgia. Goran Pandev, his nation's most capped player, all-time leading scorer, scoring a nice goal, actually. It was a lovely little move. He was in tears at the final whistle. He said, "I'm so happy. I've played in a lot of games like this before, and I think my experience helped the team to achieve this success. We'll play for our nation's pride in the final." I thought Nick Ames made a good point on Twitter yesterday when he's saying people carp and sigh at international breaks, and I definitely get the arguments against much of this one, but at their best, they elevate the sport to another level of meaning. Look at those celebrations among Scotland and the other winners tonight, and if you don't get it, then that was the end of his sentence. But he's right, isn't he? And he's right. And, you know, you could just, even just seeing Jim's little face on the Zoom beaming away for the first 15 minutes of this pod, Baz, sort of makes you realise it really does matter.
Yeah, I like international football. I mean, sometimes it can be difficult to dredge up stuff to talk about. But if you look at the match between Macedonia and Georgia, which whoever won that, it was going to be a good story. And that's one of the great things about the Nations League is that it gives those lowest tier teams, it gives one of them a chance to qualify, a chance they almost certainly wouldn't otherwise have. But some people are very snooty about international football. That's entirely their right. I get it, but I'm not one of them. However, I do think this international break is a terrible idea.
And we'll go on to a completely pointless friendly in just a second as we reflect on England 3, Republic of Ireland 0 in part 2. Welcome to part 2 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Mark says, if nobody watched England v Ireland, did it really happen? So England won 3-0. Another great performance from Jack Grealish, the best Irishman on the pitch. I presume you'll agree, Baz. He's been involved in 12 goals and 11 appearances in all competitions for club and country this season, scoring 5, assisting 7. It feels like a cliche, Anne-Marie, to clamour for Grealish to be put in the team. But it also seems like he should really be in the team. And I know there is real competition for places, especially in the formation that Southgate has, but he's a real pleasure to watch, isn't
it? Oh, I really enjoyed watching him yesterday. He just lights up the side with the way that he can control the ball, the way he gets into those tight spaces, his link-up play, particularly with Saka. He saw plenty of the ball. In fact, I was beginning to wonder if he saw a bit too much of the ball yesterday. You can see that he's elevated himself. You can see that he's starting to make better decisions. And that's because he's just, you know, he's pushing himself through the Villa team. But also those opportunities to train with the England team has paid off in dividends for him as a player. I think you're right, Max. It's the question about the formation. And I think that's going to be the debate going forward. I think the debate about him and Mason Mount playing together, I think, is now off the table and we should put that to bed. But it is about that formation, because if Southgate is going to go for that 3-4-3, where does Grealish fit in that? But then, you know, if he goes for a 4-2-3-1, I think it works perfectly. But we've wanted for such a long time competition for places. And the quality that we have now for the England team is just amazing. And so it's great to have these debates about Grealish and various other players. But for me, I think because he brings so much creativity, because he brings so much energy to that side as an attacking midfielder, because sometimes England can play a bit of a dull style, please, let's make sure that he is on the starting team sheet for Belgium.
In a 3-4-3, John, does he get in? Because it's, you know, Raheem Sterling is quite a good footballer and Marcus Rashford is quite a good footballer and Jadon Sancho is quite a good footballer as well.
Yeah, and Harry Kane tends to be pretty decent as well.
Yeah, he's all right.
Up the front, yeah. You know, you want a player like Grealish to play in the team as a supporter, because you actually want to watch a player who you like watching, and every game you watch Grealish play in, he always takes the eye and has done. I think it's Jack Grealish has been around quite a long time, hasn't he? Like 6 or 7 years, and always a player that attracts so much. And I think one of the things is about Grealish is that, as Anne-Marie said, he takes on the ball quite a lot. You could almost use him as one of those players that the other team has to mark. And so it allows other players to overload down another part of the pitch. Ireland did not have such a stratagem in place and allowed him pretty much free reign of Wembley. It's one of those things, isn't it, when managers talk about selection headaches that are nice to have. It's one of the ultimate football cliches, really. But I suppose if Grealish is a player that, if he's in your team, you have to make him almost the centre of the team just because of the way that he is and the responsibility he takes on. It's a throwback. There was a time when every team had a playmaker. Now very few do. But I think those of us that look back on Gazza, Glenn Hoddle, you know, we think of those players as not really being used correctly by the international team or the England national team. I think the player that Grealish, because he's so much more robust, it would seem, and hopefully is actually the player that I think many of us thought Jack Wilshere would be. You know, carrying the ball from midfield, creating problems for the opposition in an area where it's difficult for them to defend. He's been, I think, the player that I've enjoyed watching most this season over the last year or so. We've got to get him in the England team just because it'll be much better to watch.
Should mention Jadon Sancho scoring at Wembley. He had a. It's pretty good in the first half. Jude Bellingham, third youngest debutant for England ever at 17 years and 136 days, and Dean Henderson as well, who played in the second half. The tap-in says, for Barry, why does Stephen Kenny pick more or less the same players that Mick McCarthy and Martin O'Neill did to play a radically different style of football? Is there no one else?
I'm not sure that's fair assessment. There was a bit of a shake-up, but when he came in, he's picked players that were ignored by his predecessors, younger players that he had in the under-21s. But I think the problem is that Stephen Kenny has had very little good luck since he took over. He's been dogged by injuries, by withdrawals, COVID cases, some of which turned out to be false positives, by idiot players who couldn't sit in their own seats in an aeroplane and had to move around, and possibly cost him their team qualification for the Euros. But you know, for example, last night, James McCarthy left the squad for unspecified family reasons. Seamus Coleman had to pull out with injury. John Egan went off the pitch after 15 minutes. I think there were other injury problems as well. And it was men against boys yesterday. Let's not kid ourselves that that made a huge difference. And you say this game was a pointless friendly, and no one, like I watched the Scotland game yesterday. I have no interest in football friendlies, even unfriendly friendlies like England, Ireland, but I don't think this was entirely pointless. It gave further ammunition to people who want Jack Grealish in the England team. Jude Bellingham made his debut. That's good. Dominic Calvert-Lewin scored another goal for England. That's good. And it provided further ammunition for I think, the growing chorus of Ireland fans who think Stephen Kenny is in over his head and shouldn't have the job. I'm not one of them. I think he should be given a chance. But the stats make for grim reading. They've scored, I think, one goal in his 6 or 7 matches in charge, and they were absolutely trashed last night. I think the scoreline flattered Ireland.
Yeah, on the subject of moving seats in aeroplanes, though, Barry, when we fly to Scandinavia or Ireland for a live show, I do like to try and move to the seat directly behind you so I can prod you in the back of the head for the entire duration of the flight.
I'm well aware of that, Max, yes.
We've talked a fair bit about manager's attire. I thought Stephen Kenny's suit was a little shiny. It was a little on the game show host level. It's sort of what Patrick Keelty in 20 years might look like. That's what I thought when I watched.
Well, that's a bit harsh on Kenny, who I suspect is possibly younger than Patrick Keelty.
I think they're about a similar age, aren't they? I mean,
Patrick Keelty is 49.
Right. Well,
Stephen Kenny is 49. Yeah. Okay. No, it's more a great compliment for Patrick Keelty and how youthful he looks. Probably more important than anything that happened last night was Joe Gomez's injury, facing at least 6 months out after surgery on a knee injury after collapsing during an England training session. It's such a blow for the player before we talk about, you know, the impact on Liverpool, John, isn't it? It's a real shame for him. And look, it could have happened at Liverpool training. It could have happened anywhere, but we don't know for sure, why it happened. And that's the nature of injuries. But you do feel that without that proper pre-season, without that break, that more players are getting injured and we need to look after them.
Yeah, and one of the things Gareth Southgate said in the press conferences ahead of this game, he did seem to suggest that this was almost like a wear and tear injury, that this is likely to happen because of the stress levels that these players' bodies are being put through. Disastrous for Liverpool, of course, but it does speak to a wider point of the fact that these players, we've pretty much acted like there wasn't a summer break. They've just flogged them through that. Someone like Joe Gomez, who unfortunately missed a significant part of what is actually still a young career with a knee injury. I mean, you've got to think that when he suffered that injury, and the word is that he left the field in a significant amount of distress, he thought that, you know, that could be it for his career. And thankfully it won't be. It's not as serious as we thought, but it's still a race against time to be fit for the end of what will be Liverpool season or maybe the Euros. But yeah, I mean, let's be fair about this. Footballers are paid an awful lot of money, and the football clubs need the money. That's been made clear by many of their actions in recent months. But we can't just treat them like cattle and just send them out as they are doing. This international break, 3 matches. I mean, that's been the pattern this season. There's been international breaks of 3 matches. That all seems at least a game too much. And you can see why international managers and the likes of club managers, why the likes of Jurgen Klopp and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, they're complaining about the schedule and then having to watch their players set off across the world or across Europe, or even just into a training camp at a time when we're supposed to be observing COVID protocols and the players. I mean, it's a nightmare. It's often one of the most tedious debates about how much workload players have been put through. at every season. But I think in this case, it's right that we discuss this, and it's right that somebody, somewhere, maybe the players' union, remember them, maybe steps in and says something about this.
Maybe, I don't know if the players' union people get
do anything.
Yeah. Do they get paid enough is the question.
Well, no, I think FIFPro, which is obviously the international players' union, have spoken out quite clearly about this. But I the PFA, with a very well-paid chief executive, this does seem to be an issue of player welfare at this point. If players like Joe Gomez, an elite player, is dropping down due to a question of wear and tear, then questions have got to be asked about whether there was a need to play the Carabao Cup every week for the first few weeks of the season, whether there is a need for an extra friendly, and maybe protect their members and protect the players, and also protect the game itself, because I don't think anyone's saying that the football played this season has been as a great standard. And one of the reasons is that because the players are fatigued.
Ireland, obviously, they need every penny they can get, because the legacy of John Delaney means they're absolutely skint and in debt up to their eyeballs. There are lots of smaller nations across Europe who need money, and these friendlies generate income for them. But I think UEFA could absorb the hit if these games weren't played and prevent any of these countries, their national football associations, from going bankrupt. That could easily be done. UEFA are minted. They could swallow the hit.
Briefly, Anne-Marie, on Liverpool's title chances, this is, Van Dijk's out for a long time. Gomez is out for a long time. Trent Alexander-Arnold is out for a shorter time. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to notice that that's quite a lot of their back four from last season.
A notification flashed up on my phone about Joe Gomez's injury, and the first person that popped into my head was Jurgen Klopp. I dreaded that phone call that would have to be made to Jurgen Klopp to tell him one of his players now could be out for a foreseeable period of time. Yes, is the short answer to your question, Max. It's going to have a huge impact on Liverpool's title chances. This is going to be a big test, but it's going to be about squad rotation, squad row management, and perhaps an opportunity for one of the, dare I say, academy players, one of the squad players, to now step up and make that space their own, because they're going to need someone to plug the gaps that there are now because of these injuries to Liverpool's backline.
That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll talk about the resignation of Greg Clark. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Greg Clark resigned as FA chairman on Tuesday, subsequently resigned from his role as FIFA vice president as well, in quite an extraordinary performance at a parliamentary select committee. He played all the hits, didn't he? He managed to use a racial term that had been unacceptable for decades. He called homosexuality a life choice, said South Asians like to work in IT, and said girls didn't like having balls kicked very hard at them, all while he was trying to discuss inclusion in the game. I mean, if it wasn't serious, it's sort of satire, isn't it? You wouldn't be able to write it. I don't know how you found it, John. I just thought it was mind-blowing.
When I've seen the clip, it's almost like someone like Martin Clunes is performing some kind of, as you say, satirical performance. I this isn't the first time that Greg Clark has said things that maybe have had to be explained away after he's said them, but to compile a greatest hits collection like that is really quite something. One of the things about that is that he obviously realised that he was in big trouble, and the story around that he phoned around for support, for others to support him, and rightly nobody did. It was time to go. And then he's also gone from his sinecure with FIFA. Yes, Greg Clark went into that position as someone with a successful business career behind him, but he is of a certain generation, and he is in that successful business career. You wonder what level of scrutiny his language came under, and someone who is so prone to gaffes and use of those epithets and descriptions really shouldn't have been in that position in the first place. It was right that he went. It was right that he left his other position. good riddance at this point. Now, his people might say that he's done good work in other positions in his role over the years, but he won't be lamented after all that, I have to say.
Anne-Marie, what did you make of it?
So I was watching it live, and I didn't even do a double take when he said it. How bad is that, that I'm totally desensitized to it now? There wasn't the outrage, there wasn't the anger, there was no expletives that left my mouth when I heard what he said. It was like this, oh, here we go again kind of thing. And then somebody described it yesterday on the TV as a grisly compilation of stereotypes. I thought that was a brilliant way to sum it up. And John is right. He's got form for this before, and he has been, and somebody who's been in the vanguard of equality issues. And then he comes out with this kind of nonsense. And I should say, I think it's important to separate the FA, the organisation, and Greg Clark, because I know some really good people at the FA who would have been utterly dismayed, angry, frustrated about the words that Greg Clark chose to use when he spoke in front of DCMS. And you know, reflecting on it, it was the casual way that he spoke. It was the way that he wasn't even aware that he was digging himself into a hole when he said those words. And he is right, you know, John's right, it's totally unacceptable. The minute the words left his mouth, he should have realised that and realised that his position became absolutely untenable for me. It was just, you know, I know some people have talked about, as John pointed about, the word generation. That doesn't really wash with me. As somebody at that level of power and influence and responsibility, being that generation, you should know that already. You shouldn't be using those types of words. And I saw some people on social media talking about, well, what's wrong using the C word? That C word is rooted in hatred, in distaste, brutality. You can use that bathroom, but you can't use that bathroom because of your skin colour. You can sit at the back of the bus, but you can sit at the front of the bus. You can have a job, but you can't have that job because of your skin colour. The root of history of those particular words that he used, just absolutely, you know, just even as I think about it now, it's starting to get me annoyed. And because I just couldn't believe that he was so casual about it. He undermined everything the minute he uttered those words. And also, there wasn't much scrutiny about his role in Project Big Picture. I think he should have been scrutinised about that a lot more in front of DCMS. But as I said, he made his position untenable the minute he uttered those words, and it was right that he went. I think he should have gone the minute straight after DCMS, but probably there's probably some conversations that needed to happen behind the scenes. This is now a real opportunity to get somebody who understands the deeper issues, who understands what the FA is trying to do as a whole, as an organisation, and take it to the next level. It's, for me, you know, you talk about the best person for the job. It is the best person for the job and then some. And I hope the person who takes on that role understands the politics of the FA, but also the direction the FA want to go forward with.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, this was Greg Clark in front of the DCMS, trying to be on his best behaviour, trying desperately hard not to put his foot in his mouth. What's he like in real life?
Yeah.
That's the question. And some of what he said was well-intentioned, you know, the stuff about gay footballers. But then he just puts both feet in it again by describing being gay as a lifestyle choice. And it was right that he goed, but all those gaffes have completely overshadowed the fact that he wasn't held to account about his role in Project Big Picture, which was completely duplicitous. And it also overlooks the fact that the Premier League chief executive didn't cover himself in glory when he was interrogated either. And it overlooks the fact that several members of the committee were thoroughly ill-prepared for that particular sitting, and the questions they asked were ludicrous.
So what does that mean? The people running things and the people questioning the people running things and the people questioning them, none of them are fit for purpose. It's not a particularly great place to be.
Well, that's pretty much the impression I was left with. But if Greg Clark can take any crumb of comfort from that, it's that the fact that he said so many stupid things they made the headlines, and the fact that he wasn't really held to account for his role in Project Big Picture sort of went under the radar.
Was that the same committee where an MP stood up and tried to explain how important clubs were in the north to their local community, Jake Berry, by saying, you know, for people in the south, it's Glyndebourne or the Opera House?
No, he was making a speech in Parliament. To be fair to him, for a Tory, and this is going to stick in my craw, he was speaking up on behalf of football clubs who were in trouble, but he did it in a very cack-handed way, saying that for many people who live in London and the south of England, things like the Opera House and ballet are at the heart of their culture. That's true. And then he said, but for many of us in the north, it is our football club, our Glyndebourne, our Royal Opera, our Royal Opera House, our Royal Shakespeare Company will be Blackburn Rovers, Accrington, Stanley, Barrow, Carlisle or Sunderland. Now, the fact he had to refer to notes to remember all those teams would suggest he's not a big football fan. But I'm never out of the Glyndebourne or the Royal Shakespeare Company or the Royal Opera House, as you know, Max. But I wonder if John, having grown up in the north, in Winterfell, I would imagine he spent a lot of his time at the Northern Ballet in Leeds or the Shakespeare North Playhouse in Prescott or the Northumberland Orchestral Society or the Royal Northern Sinfonia.
I was a regular at Books and Opera House. That's actually true. But I remember Kevin Keegan saying something sort of the opposite of this, which was, I think this was when he went back to be manager of Newcastle. And he said something, classic gnomish Keegan, said something like, you know, those people down in the south, they've got the theatre. Us up here in the northeast, we've got football. And, you know, funny enough, Newcastle itself, I think, is one of the most cultured cities in Britain. You know, there's plenty of stuff going on there if you are of a cultured mind. Yes, I do think this is a classic north-south divide thing. I was tweeting about this the other day, where if you're from the north, people in the south think that you live in a coal scuttle or something like that. And if you're if you're up north, you think everyone's swanning around the King's Roads, guzzling cafe lattes. And it's a big problem in this country that has not been sorted out. And despite all the lip service paid to it and patronising football, it's not been sorted at all, and it is one of the reasons why, or one of the many reasons why we're in a mess.
Mm. Although for me, I mean, finally to be able to admit that I hate football and I've never liked it, and I'm moving to, I'm going to start Ballet Weekly, Guardian Ballet Weekly, and I'm going to move to Talk Opera, and my career, I can finally be myself and put on my, you know, I don't have to use this voice for podcasts. I can use my proper voice that I use at home, you know, and as finally get back to my roots, where I was second clarinet in Cambridgeshire County Youth Orchestra, my best years.
Didn't your father, Max, once upon critiquing our highly cerebral Talksport radio show on a Sunday morning, once suggest that you might be better served doing a poetry show on Radio 4?
No. My dad, I went back home one day and my dad had some ideas for my career. And one of these ideas was introducing poetry to Classic FM, to which I had to point out that I believe poetry had already been introduced. I believe it was, people were aware of it. And B, I didn't work for Classic FM. But that aside, it, you know, there were some excellent notes on things that would be useful for me. There's no Premier League, obviously, this weekend, but there are some enticing games in the Women's Super League, Anne-Marie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the Women's Football Weekender this weekend. Double hitters on the Saturday. Manchester United will be taking on Manchester City, and it's going to be really interesting. I'm really excited for this because Manchester United women are currently sitting top of the table. 2 years after joining the WSL, they are top of the table on 16 points, whereas City unusually are sitting in fifth. And Casey Stoney's got to take a lot of credit for the way that she's built that team, the work rate, the way they're fearless against those big teams of Arsenal, Chelsea and City as well. They know how to stay firm in the back. back in terms of their back line, but also their attacking prowess as well. Having players like Tobin Heath, Christian Press, Lauren James, sister of Reece James as well, Katie Zellum as part of that lineup. They have a real opportunity to take points off City, whereas City come into that game thrashing Bristol City Women by 8-1. There was a whole story around the coronavirus pandemic that affected the Bristol City team as they went into that game. But they will have some confidence as well because they won the FA Cup final. So that one is the one to watch for me. Of course, there'll be no Alicia Russo because she's out with injury. But the players that both sides have, Lucy Bronze in that City side, Georgia Sanway also in that City side, it's going to be a real fascinating encounter. I think it's going to be really tight between those two teams. And then on Sunday, it's Arsenal women versus Chelsea women. Chelsea looking to defend their title, of course. They're third in the table at the moment. They have beaten Arsenal, who are second in the table several times over the last few months. I think Chelsea will really expose Arsenal's vulnerabilities. Arsenal's injury list, it just grows. There'll be no Jordan Knobbs, no Lisa Evans, no Jem Beattie, and Steph Catley as well. Chelsea do have a game in hand, which also adds on the pressure onto Arsenal's shoulders. But the one thing I will say is that Arsenal has a superior goal difference, and that could become key later in the season because there are now 3 Champions League places up for grabs this season. So I think it's all to play for between those two teams on Sunday.
Anne-Marie, I saw that Susie Rack, among others, was complaining that Boreham Wood, whose Meadow Park is where this game is being played, they're not letting any newspaper journalists in to cover it because they say they can't cater for them because of COVID restrictions and because match reports aren't important. Some might agree with them on that front, but I think with women's football, where the games are not as accessible as with the men's, I would argue that match reports are quite important.
100% agree with you, Barry. I've been to Meadow Park. There's a reasonably sized press box there. I think it could be socially distanced in the right way. I've also had an impact because of coronavirus. I'm not able to go into the grounds to do my job as a presenter for certain radio shows as well now because of coronavirus. I think what got me is that line, what you said, that it's not classed as important. That's absolutely ridiculous. There are people that do enjoy reading match reports in the men's and the women's game. And I would hope that someone would come back with a bit of common sense and say, you can at least allow 2, maybe 3 written journalists into that press box. There is that space for it to be managed in the right way. And Susie was absolutely right to highlight it as well. I'm not sure if it's the same for every ground, to be clear, within the WSL, but it's a bit of a shame, particularly for this match, because under normal circumstances, when Arsenal and Chelsea play at their respective grounds, there is a full house in the press box. But so it's a real shame on this occasion. A little common sense cannot be applied on this occasion.
A couple of questions to finish with. Bristol Saints says, not really a question, I was somewhat disturbed by the contributor song during the break in the live show. We had a half-time performance. Hardly anyone looked what I imagined, with the biggest shock of all being John Bruin. To me, his voice is more clean-shaven. Are you happy to stick with your beard, or would you, for Bristol Saints delicacies, shave your beard off?
Well, the beard covers a multitude of sins, so sorry, Bristol Saints.
A multitude of sins or a multitude of chins?
Well, but that's what I mean. Yeah, both.
Takes one
both.
To know one, Barry.
yes, yeah. yeah, well, this is the lockdown 2 look, which is I didn't bother getting my hair cut during lockdown, after lockdown 1 either. So, yes. Did you like my... I did that outside. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, no, it was all wonderful, part of a wonderful performance that I am desperate to show to the world. Barry is less keen to show it to the world. I'm trying to get in touch with Carly Rae Jepsen so that I can be allowed to show it to the world.
Well, I'll tell you what, Max, if you can get permission from Carly Rae Jepsen on Twitter, yeah. You can do what you like with it.
Okay, marvellous. A couple of questions for you, Baz. Christian says, after Barry's excellent appraisal of the Belgian title race, could he provide a similarly extensive take on the Dutch league, please?
I'll tell you something, Max. I can't, but I'm sorry I only said one word during last Tuesday's podcast, because today, this podcast, is the first time, apart from a couple of very short chats with the lady behind the till in my local newsagents. This is the first time I've spoken to anyone in 3 days.
I think, look, you didn't seem out of practice, if you want a compliment.
Well thank you.
And you did a really good job.
And there's now a very good chance that once we finish this, I won't talk to anyone again till Monday. So.
Well, we've got a 3-hour radio show on Sunday, so I hope you say something.
I forgot about that.
Kieran says, did Barry get his parcel from Argos yet? Can we have an update on the pod in relation to said delivery?
I did. It arrived at about 11 a.m. the following morning. And the picture frames now have pictures in them and are hanging on my living room wall.
Ah, beautiful. A happy ending, if ever we needed one. In this difficult year of all years, Barry's Argos delivery arrives. And that'll do for today's pod. Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Well done on all your talking. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Anne-Marie.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.